Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll free, 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
It's Tuesday, and Tuesday means fun for a couple reasons. One, it's open forum on Tuesdays. Each Tuesday, we open up the phone lines for any question you've got on the life or history or faith or teachings of the Catholic Church. And you don't have to be Catholic to call, 888-318-7884. And it's also fun because Tim Staples is here with us. And Tim Staples, there's the salute. I didn't see if you did the drumming before we came in. Did you forget? Oh, it's going to be a bad show, Tim.
did the drums actually work without me doing it?
You know what? There may not have been drums in that.
No, there probably
you.
Wasn't.
No.
Well, I promise next time I'll do the drums.
Okay. Tim Staples is the Director of Apologetics and Evangelization here at Catholic Answers, the author of many books, some of which we do not mention. I forgot, Nuts and Bolts.
Nuts and Bolts, A Practical How-To Guide to Evangelization is something, for some odd reason, you don't want to talk about. But it's 14 chapters that deal with just about all sorts of major categories, from atheism to the papacy to salvation to you name it. But once again, we don't talk about it.
Why here. Is that? I can't remember how this started.
I don't either.
I don't remember how I became so anti-nuts and bolts. But,
but they can get it right here at Catholic.com or Amazon.com.
Yeah. And they can also get Behold Your Mother there, your large tome, your most recent large tome.
Yes, it is. And I'm glad you didn't say most recent book, but well, the booklet, the Mary booklet, the 20 answers is my most recent. But and check that one out too, guys. That's though I tell you, this 20 answers series is going like crazy.
Yep.
It's and we're really expanding it. There's so many topics now. Who is Jesus Christ to Mary, to salvation, to you name it.
Miracles.
I mean, it really is something. They're short little booklets that folks love, and we're trying to get them into the backs of churches. But yeah, Behold Your Mother is a historical as well as theological defense of the Marian doctrines.
And that, too, you can get at Catholic.com. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-31-TRUTH, if you prefer it in spelling form. And do you have another book coming? Like what, do you ever give a preview, or do you just, no, I can't talk about it?
It is kind of top secret. I've actually been working on a couple of books. One is kind of a kind of like Trent's Why We Are Catholic.
Yeah.
And I have that one, and I have one on eschatology. Mm-hmm. And eschatology got moved up to the front because of Trent's thing, I'm a jobber. I'm going to still write the other one, but that'll be down the road. But the eschatology book is the one I'm working on now. I'm slaving away on, and I'm excited about because there's nothing out there really from an apologetics perspective.
To tell you the truth, I want to read that one. That's the one I want. If you can get it done before the end of the world, do you think you
can? That's what we're working on, folks. Yes.
Okay. And this is, how does it work? We had the Feast of the Divine Mercy on Sunday. Does that make this week like Divine Mercy Week, or you don't get a whole week? It's just the Feast of the Divine Mercy.
I think that brings to a conclusion the octave of Easter. Mm. But we are still in the Easter season. A glorious day, though, isn't it? Divine Mercy. It is magnificent. Pope St. John Paul the Great, Sister Faustina, the whole way that came about is just miracle after miracle.
Right.
It's a glorious time in the church. In fact, I want to mention to folks, if you're in the San Diego area, I'm going to be in Murrieta, and I'm trying to remember the name. There it is.
Oh, it's right in front of me, St. Martha Catholic Church.
St. Martha's. How could I forget St. Martha's?
Right next to St. Mary's.
Right here in Murrieta. Terry Barber's going to be there. I'm going to be there. And I will be speaking on divine mercy and evangelization. Really excited about this one. So, folks, we need to pack St. Martha's this weekend. What's the date on that?
That's Saturday, April 29th, 10 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. You can register at 9 a.m. at St. Martha's Catholic Church in Murrieta, California.
It will be glorious. I can't wait.
Open forum today, 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-31-TRUTH. And good for you for remembering that, because there was someone in this building who was going to
yell at you
if I didn't make sure you talked about that coming up. So that is true, that divine mercy. It's just miraculous, all one after another. I mean, it's just extraordinary.
And if you think about it, folks, I'm going to talk about this Saturday, but you know, you had the theological problems, and there were real concerns about many things. One in particular that sticks out was Faustina's statement, of course, coming from our Lord, that mercy is God's greatest attribute. And that was a problem for many theologically, because they would say that, well, before there was a creation, there could be no mercy. Mm-hmm. Because mercy is the withholding of just punishment, mm-hmm. in an act of love. And so how can that be God's greatest attribute if it didn't even exist before there was a creation? So there was a real theological battle there. And now, of course, the answer to that is because in God, there's no real distinction between love and mercy. Mercy is simply love in action, or in act. Uh-huh. Toward his creation. And so, of course, it's his greatest attribute, because it's absolutely one with love in God. God is absolutely simple. But, you know, we can say that now, but there was a lot of theological mm-hmm. rumbling about that. And then, of course, the idea of, you know, Jesus saying, we want this Divine Mercy Sunday to be within the octave of Easter, that caused a blow up, because there was to be no feasts celebrated, right, in the octave of Easter, because it's the most sacred time. Now, of course, that's an ecclesiastical law. The yeah. church giveth, the church taketh away. Blessed be the name of the church. And so, obviously, that can be done, but it doesn't mean it wasn't a big stink in the church. So, I mean, you had the theological thing going on. You had that, which was really a matter of juridical. But then you had, of course, all the other miracles surrounding Divine Mercy, how it even came to the fore after Sister Faustina had been silenced and so forth. I mean, it's just like you said, it's miracle after miracle. But you know what it says to me is that God's message of mercy, we have a pope yeah. who is a pope of mercy right now in Pope Francis. The message of mercy is the message God wants for this generation, and that is exactly the message that we need to share. We live in a time where people are in desperate need of God's mercy.
Boy, more than ever. And I remember a couple sentences of reflection from Pope Benedict on Pope Francis's Year of Mercy, where he yes. said it's brilliant because people aren't even aware of sin. They don't know that, but they are aware of their need for mercy. He said logically it seems like you would say sin, you know, talk about sin first and then talk about mercy. Right. But he says, no, they people have the awareness that they need mercy. They just don't know why or where to get it.
It is so profoundly true, because you'll often hear folks say that, well, you can't have mercy without a sense of justice. And there's truth to that, but we have to understand human beings are not, you know, machines.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I understand justice, now I'll get mercy. That's just not the way people work. People, and especially in our day and age, people are absolutely alone. They're lonely and they're hurting. That they know. And they know that they're screwing up and they're messed up. But if you say the word sin to them, there's a natural, what are you talking about? A revulsion.
Right.
But you say mercy,
yeah,
and all of a sudden it softens the blow and people's hearts are open. And so you can go conceptually from justice and mercy, but you can also go from mercy to justice.
Right. Because we need that soil almost to be turned over first before you can
start. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is amazing and beautiful. Yeah. Let's take a quick break and then we'll be back with, the lines are filling up as they do on open forum days, 888-318-7884. The number, Tim Staples is our guest, and we'll be right back to take those calls after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Don't you just love listening to Tim Staples? Did you know you can book Tim or any of our other great speakers to speak at your parish or special event? Contact one of our seminar coordinators through the Speakers Bureau section on Catholic.com today to find out more information.
We've all heard the phrase, the new evangelization. In previous centuries, missionaries would travel to foreign lands to evangelize, but today's missionaries are more likely to focus on fallen away Catholic neighbors or relatives. But what about the old evangelization? The two millennia of Catholic missionary efforts by the likes of St. Paul, St. Augustine of Canterbury, St. Francis Xavier, and most importantly, our Lord Himself. We must not forget the methods they used to spread the faith to the farthest reaches of the world. Our situation may be new, but the essentials of evangelization always remain the same. In his new book, The Old Evangelization, How to Spread the Faith Like Jesus Did, author Eric Sammons provides a practical guide to putting these essentials into practice in everyday use in your interactions with family, friends, coworkers, and even fellow parishioners. Order your copy of The Old Evangelization today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Mark 16:15, Jesus appeared to the 11 saying, "Go into the whole world and proclaim the gospel to every creature." This St. Mark attempted to do in the writing of his gospel account. As the shortest of the synoptic gospels, his does not furnish many of the details found in the accounts of Matthew and Luke. Through his account, we see the great contrast between the glorious resurrection of Jesus and the considerable hostility he encountered from the public, the Jewish leaders, and even lack of understanding from his own disciples. Here we see that such hostility was a necessary part of the Lord's passion. His way of humility and suffering clashed so dramatically with the expectations of the Jewish people, who wanted a victorious warrior Messiah. As we celebrate the Feast of St. Mark today, we recognize the passion of Jesus as the divine mystery and hope of the human race that it truly is. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
And thank you for being with us. Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Tim Staples is our guest. 888-318-7884 is the number. And Charles in Lincoln, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Radio. You are on with Tim Staples. What's your question, Charles?
Yes, I was wondering about the tree in the Garden of Eden called the Tree of Knowledge of Good and Evil.
Yes.
Which has a forbidden fruit, and I don't understand what the name means of the tree, and to me it sounds like it means that the fruit of the tree would give the Adam and Eve knowledge of right and wrong, but right. I'm confused about it.
Sure. Great question, Charles. And it on the surface, you're right, Charles. It looks like, well, God just wants to keep them ignorant. Right, and keep them down. But actually, that's not the case. If we dive a little bit deeper, Charles, what we see is that God has already laid out for Adam and Eve who they are as created in the image and likeness of God. They have an immeasurable dignity. He has given them an incredible knowledge, and this is symbolized by, you know, we've talked about this before, Si, the naming of all the animals. Think about it, Charles. We can't do that today. We haven't named all the animals on this planet. We constantly discover new species and such. And yet Adam named each one, and that was their name, the scripture says. He was so in union with the creation and with his God. He knew God intimately. He knew the creation, and he knew himself, and he knew Eve. So he had, you know, a knowledge that, Charles, you and I could only dream of having. However, what God says is, through this, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you had this one tree which symbolizes the fact that God wants to give them free will because he doesn't want robots, Charles. He wants rational beings to love him freely. And so he says, just this one tree you cannot eat from, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. God's already promised, right? Like I said, he's already given them knowledge and so forth. But the tree represents what they cannot do. And if they try to do, this would be kind of like trying to, and remember this too, Charles, what was the temptation of the devil? The devil, when he tempts him, he says, oh, God knows that if you eat that, you'll know like he knows. Well, again, God's already promised them. They're already like God by the nature that God had given them. The devil lies and says, look, you do this. Basically, what the tree represents, and they're going after it, is trying to get what God's already promised them, but to get it by their own power instead of God's power working in them and through them. And Charles, that's the same temptation that we have today. Instead of trusting God and allowing God's power to transform us, and then we have peace, we have love, we have joy, and we have a depth of knowledge and peace that you can't get anywhere else. But what do? Charles, every time we sin, what are we doing? We're saying, I want it my way. We're singing the Frank Sinatra song, right? I'll do it my way. I'll get my peace my way. And you know what? You can't do it. And Adam and Eve quickly learned, didn't they? They thought, they gave into the lie of the devil, the temptation of the devil. You can do it. You don't need God for this. You can get it yourself. And what did that do? It divided them. The knowledge of God was blocked, was damaged, not blocked completely, but damaged. Their knowledge of each other, Adam and Eve, they become ashamed and they're covering, whereas before they were not. And the relationship between them and the creation, now with the sweat of the brow, whereas before there was this harmony. So, Charles, that's basically it in a nutshell. Does that help you at all?
Yes. So they already had knowledge of right and wrong before they ate the fruit, right?
They sure did. They had a better knowledge than you and I. And plus, think about it, Charles, their lower appetites were perfectly ordered to their higher intellectual powers, right? The power of intellect and will. As a result of original sin, their intellect was darkened, their will was weakened, and we all lost that sanctifying grace that they had as a result of that sin, which leads us to have darkened intellects and weakened wills. So our knowledge is not nearly what it would be if there were no sin. Appreciate your call, though, Charles.
Thank you very much, Charles. We go now to Joe in Akron, Ohio, listening on Living Bread Radio. Joe, you're on with Tim Staples.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk and ask a question about the New Apostolic Reformation. And I have some friends who are involved deeply in this movement. And it seems like it's really growing quickly. And I know that they're just like appointing prophets, like drive-through prophets almost. So you can appoint them as quick as you want. And I'm just wanting to get your opinion and how you witness to people like that.
Right. Well, I can relate to that movement because within, and it's generally a movement that has arisen within charismatic and Pentecostal circles in Protestantism. In fact, the late, I don't know if you know him, but the late Deacon Alex Jones, who unfortunately just passed away not long ago, was a former Pentecostal holiness minister. I was in the Assemblies of God. There was a constant desire, and there still is in Pentecostal circles, to get back to the early church and to worship the way that they worshiped in the book of Acts, right? Famously, Alex Jones sought to find out how they worshiped, not just in the 28 chapters of the book of Acts, but what happened in Acts chapter 29, right? And 30 and 31 and through 1,000, right? And that's how he ended up becoming Catholic. But there, you find in Pentecostal circles, there's always been that emphasis on apostolicity or getting back to the apostles. So this is what's going on here. This movement, though, is sort of attempting to revitalize the apostolic gift that we have modern day apostles and that sort of thing. So that's where they fall short. But I think, my brother, this is a great opportunity to evangelize, because if you're going to be truly a true apostle in the New Testament church, you have to have hands laid on you by an apostle, right? Go to Romans chapter 10, verse 14, right? How shall they preach unless they be sent, says St. Paul. In order to preach, you have to be sent by an apostle or one whom an apostle has ordained. Go to Acts chapter 15, verses 24 through 28. And the apostles talk about those who went out from them, but without a mandate from them to do what they were doing. And so they were rejected. I think what's happening here is this can be an opening for you and I to evangelize about true apostolic succession, because you can't come along 2,000 years later and say, hey, I'm an apostle. No, sorry, it doesn't work that way. You know, when Judas died in Acts chapter 1, verse 20 through 22, what do we see? What do? Do they say, oh, bummer, man, Judas is gone? No, they don't. They get together and they choose a replacement. And Peter leads the charge. It's Peter who decides how it's going to be done, and it's done. And then you'll also see there in Acts chapter 1, verse 20, that the office of apostle in succession is referred to as bishopric. It says, and let another man take his bishopric, episcope. And so the bishops of 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1 and elsewhere are the successors of the apostles. So I think that's the way, at least that's the way I recommend that we deal with these folks in the new apostolic reformation. Let's talk about apostolic succession from a biblical perspective.
Okay, Joe?
I know one of the things. One of the things that they really get into is talking about how through government, through business, that they're going to bring all these people who are going to be anointed. And it's not until everybody gets anointed that Jesus is going to come back. And that's how they're going to bring Jesus back.
Sure. Yeah. It's a kind of that. That's another characteristic of this movement. It's millenarist. There's that millenarianism that became very popular in the late 19th century. With Darby, the Congregationalist minister, and then leading up to the early 20th century with Scofield, and then the craze, the rapture craze, and all of that, this idea that somehow, you know, we can bring about the second coming by our, you know, machinations and such. That's actually a dangerous concept. The Catholic Church has a very different take on that. We believe in the last days. We're not going to bring the kingdom here. Now we pray, you know, thy kingdom come. Yes, in our hearts. We want Jesus to come and reign in our hearts and throughout the world. But bottom line is, my friend, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 tells us that the second coming is not going to happen until there comes first the great apostasia in Latin, the apostasy and the revelation of the Antichrist and a persecution that will be worse than anything we've ever seen. That doesn't fit in that that rapture mentality and that mentality of in this new apostolic reformation movement that, you know, it's just going to get better, better, and better, and then we'll usher in Jesus, right? Nope, that's not the way it's coming. There's not coming resurrection until there is first crucifixion, my friend. Appreciate your call, though, my friend. We got to keep an eye on this movement. It's a fascinating movement.
Thank you very much for that call, Joe. We'll go now to Morrow in Pembroke Pines, Florida, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Morrow, we may have to get some of your answer on the other side of the break, but go ahead. Let's start with your question.
That's okay. Well, first of all, Tim, I just want to thank you sincerely from my heart that you are such a good example, and I want to thank you for your work in defending the Catholic faith. And you've been an inspiration for me and many times, and I've been signing up for my faith, and I'm trying to grow. You know, and to do that in whatever way that I can. So
well,
just want to thank you so much.
I really appreciate your kind words, my friend. How can I help you?
Yeah, so my girlfriend, my beautiful girlfriend, I love her so much. She is Protestant, and we are in a phase right now where we are getting deep and we're having some disagreements. And basically, we've sat down. She's agreed to buy a Catholic Bible. I bought her one. She's really happy with it. You know, she was shocked to find out the book's taken out. And now we're trying to get to the authority of the church.
Gotcha.
And she understands the church was built on Peter,
okay.
But how can we link that to the Catholic Church, and why is the church infallible? And that is her biggest issue.
Nice job getting that out right before the break, Morrow. When we come back, how is the church related to the authority of Peter? Right here on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here to tell you about the most exciting and innovative Catholic book in years. In today's world, people from countless perspectives pose challenges to our Catholic faith every day, in conversations, through the mass media, on the internet, and more on the infinite collection of social media platforms. There's no getting away from this daily onslaught. We as Catholics need to stand strong, to be prepared, to mount a daily defense, to respond to the many challenges that we, as believers, are presented with every day. To that end, my good friend and apologist extraordinaire Jimmy Akin has come up with what will surely be a great resource for years to come, a daily defense. A daily defense takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, 366 in all, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, which challenges and answers index alphabetically by scripture verses or by topic. So finding the answers can be quick and easy. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting Catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
With his new DVD, Understanding Revelation, Decoding the Bible's Most Mysterious Book, Jimmy Akin unlocks the secrets of Revelation so that anyone can understand them. Packed with almost 2 hours of eye-opening material, it paints an entirely different picture of the book of Revelation than the one most people already have. The book of Revelation was meant to reveal God's message to his church. And in Understanding Revelation, Jimmy Akin shows you how it does exactly that. Order your copy of Understanding Revelation today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open forum. Tim Staples, air drumming, is our guest this hour. Tim is the Director of Apologetics and Evangelization here at Catholic Answers. Really good air drummer, too. And when we left, Mauro was asking about how can you, even if you acknowledge the authority of Peter, how can you connect that to the authority of the church today?
Yeah, and that it's a great question. And Mauro, I'd recommend highly that you get a hold of a CD set I did here called The Shocking Truth About the Pope and the Early Church Fathers. In that CD set, I take you from the New Testament in the first CD. Then I go right through, like kind of what we were talking about earlier, going through Acts 28 and then 29, because there's only 28 chapters in the book of Acts. But we go to chapter 29, and I take you all the way through the first 600 years of the Christian era and demonstrate how that what we see in the New Testament continues in the Catholic Church. But I think the key is, number one, and I think you've already got a good start here with your girlfriend, because she acknowledges that Jesus established a church on Peter. That's fantastic, because there's not a lot of Protestants that would acknowledge that. So that's good. But then the next step you have to take, Mauro, is to ask, okay, well, where does the New Testament tell us that, okay, I established my church on Peter and the apostles, Matthew 16, 18, 19, Matthew 18, 15 through 18. Remember, he says, if you have a problem with your brother, you go to your brother, you try to settle. If you can't settle it, you take one or two. If you can't settle it still, you tell it to the church. And the church has the final say. That's the way Jesus established it. Now, you have the church, meaning there, I should say, in Matthew 18, 15 through 18, all the apostles in union with Peter, because they were all there. In Matthew 16, he calls out Peter alone and gives to him uniquely the keys of the kingdom. And then similarly says, whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven. So Peter has this unique authority to bind and loose, and he's the only one who has the keys. And then you have all the apostles that have a collegial authority with Peter, right? All right, so your girlfriend evidently agrees with that. But here's the problem. Where does the New Testament, where does Jesus ever say, okay, I'm building my church on Peter and the apostles and all this, but that's only for the first century, right? After the first century, I'm going to make a switch to sola scriptura. Then you're going to go by, nobody will have any more authority than anybody else. Everybody will just go to the Bible. That is so foreign. This is what you have to point out to your girlfriend. That is so contrary to anything that we see in the New Testament. In fact, Jesus, in the context of establishing his kingdom, which is the church, and he gives this power. Let's look at Matthew's gospel. What does he end up saying in Matthew 28:18? All authority is given me in heaven and earth. Go, therefore, teach all nations, baptize in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I've commanded you. And lo, I will be with you all days, verse 20 says, even unto the end of the age. So what's implied there is that this authority that he established is going to be here till the end of time, not till the end of the first century. Right. And so then you want to go to the book of Acts, for example, in Acts chapter 15, and show how the church functioned in the book of Acts. It was not a sola scriptura church. When they had a problem that threatened to tear the fledgling church apart, what did they do? They had a church council. Just look at Matthew, or I should say Acts chapter 15, verses 7 through 11 there. You know, Peter stands up, they declare the truth of the matter, and that's the way things happen. Now, again, in my CD set, The Shocking Truth About the Pope and the Early Church Fathers, I take you right from the New Testament. We go to letters like Clement, who, by the way, is mentioned in Philippians 4:3 as a companion of St. Paul. Clement of Rome, who was the fourth pope, was actually asked, this was probably about 90 A.D., to settle a problem that was going on in the Corinthian church. And this is amazing, Cy, because John the Apostle was still alive at this time. And yet they didn't go right over to Ephesus and ask John to help. They appeal all the way to Rome in the West. Why is that? Because the Church of Rome was the recognized authority, the successor of St. Peter. And we go down the list. In my CD set, I take you to St. Ignatius of Antioch when he writes his seven letters on his way to martyrdom. It's an incredible how you see when he talks to, for example, the church, the Magnesians. You know, in paragraph 6, in fact, in that little the letter there, he talks about how the bishop presides over the people there in that locality. But then when he writes his letter to the Romans, his language changes completely, and he talks about how this church, the church at Rome, presides in love in the country of the Romans, meaning not just that the bishop presides over his people, but this church itself presides over the other churches. And on we go. From day one, St. Irenaeus in 180 AD in book 3, chapter 3, paragraphs 1 through 3 in his great work Against Heresies. Phenomenal. There, he goes through a litany of heresies, mostly the Gnostic heresies of the second century, answering them. But right in the middle of his letter, he lists all the bishops of Rome all the way back to Peter and says, this is the standard whereby the preaching of the church and the apostolic tradition has come down even unto us, right? And down we go. I mean, you could go to, you know, St. Augustine in his famous letter. I think it's letter 131, as I recall. He's got a massive number of letters, but it's a letter concerning the Donatists, and he lists all the bishops of Rome. Like Irenaeus 200 years before, he lists all, actually 300 years before, he lists all the bishops of Rome all the way back to Peter and says, look over this list and you will not find one Donatist among them. This is the faith of Christians. For 1,000 years, this was the faith of Christians. And so for folks to come on Johnny Come Latelys and say, oh no, that's all wrong. Now we go by a book, the Bible alone. That is absolutely foreign. And it's foreign to the New Testament as well as church history.
Thank you very much, Morrow, for that call. It is an extraordinary history. When you lay it out like that, it's wonderful to hear it.
It really is.
888-318-7884 is the number. It's open forum here on Catholic Answers Live today. And we go to Rich in Cocoa, Florida, listening on 920 AM. Rich, your question for Tim Staples.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yes.
I had a question. I'm doing a will with my wife. And I just wanted to find out, what is the church's teaching on burial? Is it okay to be cremated, or do they still prefer the traditional burial?
Great, great question, Rich. In fact, there was a document that came out recently, kind of an updated document on this very question, dealt with more than that, but dealt with this as well. And so I think your gut is right, Rich. What the church has said is the traditional burial is preferred, but cremation is certainly allowed as long as someone is not being cremated out of a disdain for the body. As a matter of history, Rich, in the Middle Ages, the church condemned cremation because of the fact that we had this problem that we were talking about with an earlier caller, the early Gnostics, that a Gnostic heresy that lasted well over 1,000 years in the church and transmogrified into so many different sects, but they had this common thread of a disdain for the material world and for the body. And so they cremated the body out of a disdain for the body. And, you know, as is often the case, that mentality ebbed its way into the church. And the church stepped in and said, no more cremation, because we need to ensure that folks understand the body is good. Creation is good. We are a hylomorphic being. We're not just ghosts in a machine. The machine needs to be discarded, but we are a body-soul composite. That's who we are, so the body is good. So today, again, while the traditional burial body intact is preferred, it's permitted because we don't have that massive problem any longer about Gnostics and Catholics believing in the body being evil like that. So it's permitted. But like you said, though, there is a preference for the traditional burial. So you can cremate. Okay, Rich?
That is awesome. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Rich. And thanks to everybody listening to Catholic Answers Live and watching on Facebook Live, YouTube Live, and Periscope. Tim, the following question typed in by an anonymous viewer on YouTube. Can objective morality be explained through evolution without God?
And great question, anonymous. And the short answer is absolutely not. You cannot have objective morality when you don't have a source for that morality. And what do I mean by that? Well, look, if creation is simple, or I shouldn't even say creation, right? If everything that is around us is simply an accident of an explosion that happened 13.7 billion years ago. Now, don't get me wrong here. God could create any way he wanted to, and he may well, and it appears he did create through an evolutionary process. That's a matter of science that's debatable, but I think the evidence is pretty strong. But the point is, if this thing is all an accident, and the reason why Cy and I are sitting here talking to each other is because of an accident that happened 7 million years ago in Central Africa, some tectonic plates moved and the mountains arose, and the folks, I think it was on the west side of the mountains, looked up, and Cy came as a result of that. And the ones east side looked down, and they were the monkeys and all of that. I mean, this is an oversimplification, but that's basically it. It's an accident that happened. And so the only reason why we're any different than the monkeys at all is because we have a few, billion extra neurological synapses. There is no reason for there to be an objective morality. Put it this way, anonymous. There would be no essential difference between somebody taking a gun and killing someone and a wave crashing up on the beach, because both would be equally accidental if there were not a God who created us with a purpose, a plan, a dignity that transcends us. And think of this as well, because there are evolutionists, atheists, and such who try to come up with a morality. But how are you going to bind anybody else to your morality that you do come up with? Because you have no authority over Cy or me or anyone else. That's just your opinion that came about because of an accident that happened 13 billion years ago and 7 million years ago. So the bottom line is, my friend, without God, there is no objective morality.
And then everything is permitted, as Nietzsche said.
That's right. And any morality ends up being Nietzsche's will to power, because you're ultimately just saying, well, this is what I think, and I'm going to impose it on you. And in the long term,
that never works. And it ends badly.
Yeah, that always ends badly for somebody. Not usually for the powerful.
Yes. Although, talk to Hitler. It ended pretty bad for him, too.
I didn't think about that. Okay, all right. We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live. I got nothing for that.
Yes. Call and ask Tim your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here to remind you about a very special event that you're going to want to save the date for. This September 28th to the 30th, we'll be hosting our fourth annual National Apologetics Conference here in beautiful San Diego. And this is one conference you're not going to want to miss. The theme is the reunion of all Christians, and we've got an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to fire you up. Catholic historian Steve Weidenkopf, apologist Mark Brumley, apologist Devin Rose, plus all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. For almost four decades, Catholic Answers has been engaging our separated brethren in charity to bring them to the fullness of the truth. Join us this September for a lively and inspiring conference designed to help you play an active part in the reunion of all Christians. We've got lower prices than ever before and a beautiful venue in San Diego, California. You don't want to miss it. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today to register.
Catholic Answers Live comes to EWTN Television.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett. Join me for a show dedicated to Catholic apologetics and evangelization as we connect viewers to prominent leaders in the church today and touch on just about everything relating to the church, from doctrinal issues to family concerns, social issues, evangelization, ethics, you name it.
Catholic Answers Live TV, Wednesday, 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Television.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Open forum both hours today. Next hour, Jim Blackburn will be here with us to address your questions or concerns. This hour, Tim Staples, Director of Apologetics and Evangelization here at Catholic Answers, is our guest. And we go now to Karen in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart. Karen, you are on with Tim Staples.
Hi, Karen.
All right. Well, you know what? We'll hang on for a sec. Karen, we're not going to leave you. So we'll go to another call. And if you're still there when you pick up the phone next time, we'll get to that call. We'll go now to John in New Orleans, Louisiana, listening on 690 AM. John, your question for Tim Staples.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my question.
Yes.
I'll actually take my question too off the air and listen to it through the radio. But my question basically is, would Jesus have always known of his divine nature and identity, or if not, at what point in his life would he have, obtained the fact that he was the Christ?
Yes, great. It's a great question, and the answer is yes, he would have known of his messianic dignity, of his dignity, even from the womb, according to Pope Pius XII in Mystici Corporis, and I'm trying to remember, I think it's paragraph 75, my friend. If I'm wrong, it's right around in there. But Pope Pius XII taught that hardly had Christ been conceived in the womb when he enjoyed the beatific vision of God. Now, that particular teaching of Christ possessing the beatific vision from the moment of his conception, though it was taught there in an encyclical, that's not something that's been infallibly defined. In fact, John Paul, I think it was just like an audience, a Wednesday audience. I'd have to look that up. But John Paul tended not to use that language of beatific vision, although I believe Christ had the beatific vision from the moment of his conception, as Pius XII did. It's not something that's binding upon Catholics. But what is very interesting here. In other words, there can be debate about the beatific vision. But what you have in paragraph 474 of the Catechism. And I quote, "By its union to the divine wisdom in the person of the Word incarnate, Christ enjoyed in his human knowledge the fullness of understanding of the eternal plans he had come to reveal." Very important right there. And then in paragraph 478, so remember this, paragraph 474 and 478, "Jesus knew and loved each of us and all of us during his life, his agony and his passion, and gave himself up for each one of us. The Son of God loved me and gave himself for me." There he's quoting Galatians 2:20. "For he loved us all with a human heart. For this reason, the Sacred Heart of Jesus, pierced by our sins and for our salvation, is quite rightly considered the chief sign and symbol of that love with which the divine Redeemer continually loves the eternal Father and all human beings without exception." So notice here, and by the way, there's one other thing I wanted to show you here. The Catechism also tells us that Christ had an immediate knowledge. That's a very important word. I think that's paragraph 473. Let's see here. Assumed out of the human knowledge. Let's see here. Oh, boy. It's right around here in paragraph 472 or 473. Same time as the human nature. Right. Let's see here.
I know it's
yes.
there.
It's there it is.
I knew it. I knew if I all just right. said something.
That's it. Paragraph 473. "At the same time, this truly human knowledge of God's Son expressed the divine life of his person, the human nature of God's Son, not by itself, but by its union with the Word, knew and showed forth in itself everything that pertains to God. Such as, first of all, in the case with the intimate and immediate knowledge that the Son of God made man had of his Father, the Son in his human knowledge also showed the divine penetration he had into the secret thoughts of human hearts." But read that section there, paragraph 472 all the way down to 478. It's beautiful. But here's the bottom line. Yes, he had an immediate knowledge. Now, the Catechism doesn't use beatific vision, although I argue there's really no difference because, now, to get theologically precise here, folks could say, well, this could be an infused knowledge that's not necessarily beatific. All right, I'll grant you that. But it's an immediate knowledge of the Father, which means it's a knowledge that bypasses the act of the human intellect abstracting the forms from material things like you and I do in our discursive coming to know something discursively. According to the Catechism, Christ had an immediate knowledge. That means he doesn't have to. It bypasses the normal mode of coming to understand, and that's very important. So he had that intimate knowledge of God, and therefore he had the knowledge of his own divine person as well as his human nature. So that's a long way, I know. I kind of went a long way to say the answer is yes. He understood who he was. And I always say this to folks, if Jesus didn't know who he was, then you and I are in big trouble. I kid you not, Cy. I read this years ago. I was researching to do some a presentation on Christology. And I kid you not, I found a commentary where the author actually says that when Christ asked the apostles in Matthew 16:13, "Who do men say that I am?" he was asking it because he didn't know.
Oh, come on.
He was like, see, he was inquiring, please help me to, like.
I need some feedback on this.
That's right. The old song. Who was that? Was that Toto that sang this song? Please tell me who I am.
No,
right?
No, I know who that was. That wasn't Toto, but he needed a focus group. So you're saying that Jesus needed a focus group.
Please tell me, help me. And Peter helped him out, to explain, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Folks, once again, if Jesus had to come to know who he was, then you and I are in big trouble. He knew who he was, and we see that not only in the Catechism taught so beautifully, but you also see that beautifully symbolized in the finding in the temple in Luke's Gospel, chapter 2, where Jesus, as a 12-year-old boy, is confounding the wisest minds of the day, who were absolutely shocked, and not only at his questions, but at his answers, how he was showing forth, you know, the divine wisdom that the Catechism talks about.
Thank you very much, John, for that call. We're going now to Andrea in San Antonio, Texas, listening on 89.7 FM. Andrea, you're on with Tim Staples.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Yes.
I have a question. So just kind of, I just wanted you to try to elaborate on what you said as far as about the Antichrist.
Yes.
Us knowing, like, in the end of days, how are we going to know when this happens? Or how are we going to know who this person or this being is? Are we
yes.
going to see it? Are we going to know because we're Christians, because
yes.
we talk to each other, because of the faith? How is that going to happen?
I believe we will know it the same way we know anything else as Christians. Listen to the Pope and listen to the bishops in union with him, because the Pope will ultimately identify who the Antichrist is. Is the church, Holy Mother Church, that will be here till the end of time. And incidentally, is that Andrea? Is
yes.
this? Okay, well, Andrea, in every generation for 2,000 years, Jesus has told us, this is what you do. I mentioned this earlier on the broadcast. This is what you do if you have a problem about the faith. You go to your brother. If you can't settle it, what do? Right? You may have heard me say this earlier, Matthew 18, 15 through 18. Then you get together with your brothers and sisters. So you're right, Andrew, me and Cy and folks here, well, man, this looks like him, looks like him. But ultimately, it is the church that is the final arbiter. And this is why it's so important to be Catholic, folks. Imagine this, Andrea, you have millions and millions of people, fundamentalist evangelicals, who believe they will never see the Antichrist, right? So they will be wide open to be duped by the Antichrist. Because while the Catholic Church is saying this is the Antichrist, they'll be saying, no, no, are you kidding? He's speaking wonderful words, as 2 Thessalonians tells you, when he's first revealed. He's going to be the answer to everything. He'll be that, you know, he'll be the avatar of avatars for the Hindus. He'll be the Messiah for the Jews. He'll be, you know, everything to everyone, right, before the horns come out, and he becomes identifiable to everyone, just how evil he is. But the bottom line is, Andrea, we listen to the church. We are so blessed to be Catholic.
How's that for you, Andrea?
It's a good answer, but would it be possible that even some Catholics wouldn't recognize it either?
Sure, absolutely. There are Catholics who don't listen to the Pope today. Right? There are lots of people that call themselves Catholic, but, you know, when the church says something they don't like, you know, they say so much for the church. But I am talking about true Catholics who listen to the voice of the shepherd. From John chapter 10, Jesus is the shepherd, and he established Peter as the shepherd, right? He prophesied in John 10:16, there shall be one fold and one shepherd. Who is that shepherd? John 21, 15 through 17, he said, Peter, shepherd my lambs, shepherd my sheep. So we who truly are Catholic listen to the voice of the shepherd speaking through the shepherd on earth, and that is Peter and his successors. Thanks for your question, though. Great question, Andrea.
And if you want to hear Tim speak locally here, Saturday at 10 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., the Divine Mercy Conference in Marietta is at St. Martha Catholic Church. Next hour,
Jim
Blackburn. Jim Blackburn will be here for more open forum on Catholic Answers Live. So dial if you've got questions. We've got another hour to do this. Thank you very much, Tim Staples.
Thank you, Cy Kellett. You're a good man.
Are you sure? Maybe you should check with the Pope, because what if I'm the... No, I'm not. All right, see you in a minute on Catholic Answers Live.
God bless you, man.